This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
I know I used this yesterday, but honestly, it is just so good.
Is the Prime Minister going to get a deal with the EU? Don't know. Is she going to be able to get it through the Commons? Don't know about that either.
Don't know. There is a Brexit deal, we think. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 14th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. All right, so let me set the scene for you here. London, this evening, Greenwich. Meantime, a single television camera fixed on the door of number 10 Downing Street, through which comes a beleaguered-looking Prime Minister Theresa May, who gives a two-and-a-half-minute statement about the 585-page draft Brexit deal we learned about yesterday and that her cabinet had just spent hours debating. The operative part of the statement went like this.
I firmly believe that the draft withdrawal agreement was the best that could be negotiated, and it was for the cabinet to decide whether to move on in the talks.
And they did decide to move on in the talks. As we do with all things Brexit, we called Stephen Beard in London to hash this thing out. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So as I said, this thing runs 585 pages. Just the preamble takes five pages, all the throat clearing and the wherefores and all of that. But it boils down to one thing, this whole deal, this whole cabinet meeting today is one issue, right?
Absolutely. I mean, by far the most difficult, most contentious issue has been the so-called Irish backstop. Under this draft deal, the UK has agreed to stay in a customs union with the EU until it strikes a free trade deal. However long it takes, they will stay that close to the EU so that they avoid a hard border in Northern Ireland.
Other than that, a word about what this proposed arrangement is not. It is not a roadmap for the future relations between the EU and Britain, right?
No, not at all. This is the divorce deal. This is the withdrawal agreement. This deals only with the terms of Britain's departure from the bloc. The future trade relationship between Britain and the EU will be negotiated after the UK officially, formally leaves the bloc on March the 29th, 2019.
The Prime Minister said this evening, London time, standing before 10 Downing Street, that she's going to make a statement in Parliament tomorrow. There are many, many hurdles this thing has to clear, not least of which is a no-confidence vote and more division within the British body politic, right?
Yes. I mean, the biggest hurdle by far was not this meeting with the cabinet. It is the fact that this has to pass through the UK Parliament. And at the moment, that looks very unlikely. The opposition Labour Party will probably vote against it. And oddly enough, both Brexiteers and Remainers in the ruling Conservative Party say they're going to vote against it too. Brexiters, like lawmaker Mark Francois, don't like the Irish backstop and the fact that Britain will have its rules and regulations set by Brussels.
That is not Brexit. That is not what 17.4 million people in this country voted for.
And some Remainers, like lawmaker Anna Soubry, say that this is a bad deal and many British people are now having second thoughts about Brexit.
Our country has made a terrible mistake, and we should have the right to revisit the decision that we made over 2.5 years ago.
All right, so quickly, Stephen, because we're running out of time, that 2.5 years ago thing matters because the European economy now is changing, right? Germany's reporting a slowing economy. There's the Italian debt thing you were telling us about. It's not the same European economy that we're dealing with.
No, that's true. And it's odd, though, that the whole Brexit debate in the UK has been rather divorced from events on the continent. You still get a lot of people here saying we've got to have a second referendum. It's going to be a disaster if we leave the EU. And certainly it'll be a disaster if we leave the EU without a trade deal. They have been conjuring up lurid images of shortages of food and medicine if there is no departure deal.
There is, in theory, now a deal. It goes to Parliament tomorrow with the Prime Minister making a statement. Stephen Beard is on that story for us in London. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Kai.
With the caveat that foreign exchange does indeed carry significant risk of loss, the British pound-US dollar trade was a pretty good proxy for what the politicians were debating today. Sterling was down all day against the greenback, made back all its losses, though, and then some, as May started talking. Equities, today there was no making back of any losses. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. First, there was the Amazon HQ2 buildup. Then there was the Amazon HQ2 announcement. Now, of course, comes the Amazon HQ2 blowback. Worries over rising rents, crowded subways and highways, and big municipal giveaways, to name just a couple. We're going to have to wait to see how all of that plays out. But here is something we know going in. This is a labor story. And one of the big reasons that Amazon went with New York and Northern Virginia is because both have big pools of tech talent. And if that supply runs low, there is a ready resupply in the form of local colleges and universities. Marketplace's Amy Scott has the higher ed implications of Amazon's move.
Virginia Tech was already planning a new innovation campus in Northern Virginia. President Tim Sands says Amazon's arrival will just speed things up. The university and the Commonwealth of Virginia will each invest $250 million initially, and Amazon gets access to a whole new pool of graduates.
They're going to have to recruit, though. These are not people we're delivering to their doorstep. They're going to be in there with everybody else.
Nearby George Mason University is also investing $250 million with the goal of tripling the number of computer science graduates. New York has been working to develop its tech pipeline, too, from Cornell University's new tech campus to established schools like Columbia and NYU. Julie Samuels is executive director of Tech NYC, a coalition of tech companies and investors. She says it's not just about luring companies like Amazon and Google.
Increasingly, every company is a technology company. Financial institutions, media companies, advertising companies.
And what do the schools get in return for producing all this tech talent?
They get jobs for their students, which creates more demand for those seats, which creates more applications, which creates
That's marketing professor Scott Galloway at NYU.
And also more alumni who go on to be wealthy, who then in turn give money back.
There are risks, too. Uber teamed up with Carnegie Mellon a few years ago to develop driverless cars and ended up driving off with about 50 of its robotics experts. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
A brief-ish detour to trade and tariffs now, away from the headlines of steel and aluminum, down farther on the harmonized tariff schedule to electronics and electronic components, because, seriously, just look around. Electronics are pretty much everywhere now, right? DF Electronics is in Cincinnati, Ohio. It's a family-run electronics maker. Ann Fine runs accounting and personnel. It is her family business, by the way. Ann, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai. It's nice to be here.
Do me a favor and tell me what DF Electronics does. What do you make and who do you make it for?
We make printed circuit boards that go into a variety of mostly industrial controls, anywhere from medical furniture to pumps and anything in between.
Okay. So the reason we called you are those printed circuit boards and all the things that go on those printed circuit boards. Where do you get your components?
Any given circuit board can have anywhere from a half a dozen to a couple hundred different components on it. Most electronic components are built overseas, and a lot of them are built in China.
So as we sit here in a tariff economy, what is your exposure? I mean, you know, you're the accounts materials manager. I'm sure you look at these line items every day. What are you seeing?
It's frightening. And the thing is everyone involved, from the manufacturers down to us, is sort of making this up as we go. Hmm. We're seeing some tariff costs defined. We're seeing some component costs simply go up. We're seeing some distributors that haven't done anything yet, even though we know that some of those products are tariff products.
How do you keep the books? How do you keep the accounts when you don't know what's what, sort of?
Well, and that's really the nightmare. We're sort of making it up as we go, and the only solace is that literally everyone else in the business is doing the same thing. At the moment, I'm in the middle of drafting a letter to go out to all of our customers that basically says we're going to do the best we can. But what's likely to happen is at the end of a purchase order, we'll look at our increased cost that we did not expect at the time that we quoted, and we'll do that as a one-time charge, and we'll separate out tariff costs when we know them. But when they're simply price increases, we don't know where those came from.
What's your sense of how your customers are going to react, or how have they been reacting since this has been going for a while? Are they saying, "And you can take this purchase order and invoice and you know what with it?" Or are they working with you?
They really don't have an option because it's the same for all of their board houses. So any of our competitors are going to have the same issue.
What do you do, Anne, if, as seems by all evidence now, that this will not end anytime soon, what do you do if this keeps going for like another, 18 months, 2 years?
We're going to be playing it by ear. The tariff costs will get factored in more and more as it becomes more apparent that they're not going away. All of that really is to be determined, and as you're very well aware, it's the unknown that's the scariest thing in business.
And fine. She runs personnel and accounting at DF Electronics, a company your dad founded, as I said, 40-something years ago in Cincinnati, Ohio. And thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Kai, thank you so much.
Coming up,
over 200 venues all over the world. So on any given moment, right now, there's an event going on somewhere within AEG.
One CEO, so many people to entertain. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 205 points today, 0.8%, ended at 25,080. The S&P 500 dropped 20 points, about 0.75%, closed at 2701. The NASDAQ down 64 points, 0.9%, finished at 71.36. A sell-off in tech helped sour the mood. Apple led the way, peeling off 2.8%. Today, shares of Netflix rewound about 2.6%. From the Department of No Good Deed Goes Unpunished, retailer Macy's reported doubling net income last quarter and predicted more of the same to come. However, shares crashed anyway, unraveling more than 7%. Today, bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell 3.12% is the yield. You're listening to Marketplace. Not everybody gets a chance to learn about the economy in school. Marketplace helps you continue your education in a way that's smart, accessible, and hopefully even a bit fun. Your donation is not only an investment in your own learning, but also in helping us make more people smart about the economy, and that is good for everyone. To learn how you can help, visit marketplace.org/investors, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Mitchell Hartman took us to Toledo, Ohio yesterday for a look back at how the Bush and Obama auto industry bailouts of a decade ago are playing out today. $80 billion of government money, remember, to Chrysler, GM, and GMAC to protect millions of carmaker and carmaker-adjacent jobs. In Toledo, as Mitchell was saying, there's a Fiat Chrysler Jeep plant that's doing all right 10 years after the financial crisis. Today, he goes to Kenosha, Wisconsin, a city with a long and proud tradition of automobile production that's come to an end, but where, even without car making, things are still looking pretty good.
Halfway between Chicago and Milwaukee along Lake Michigan sits Kenosha, Wisconsin. It's a place with a lot of auto history. One of the first mass assembly plants opened there in 1902, a year ahead of Henry Ford's. A union organized in 1933, before the UAW. And for decades, tens of thousands worked in the auto plants of American Motors and Chrysler. Until, by 2010, they didn't anymore.
I was there for all the closures.
John Fox is 58, grew up in Kenosha in an auto worker family.
I was hired in 1979. Then in 1988, they shut down the lakefront and most of the main plant.
That first closure in the 1980s, it was the big one. More than 5,000 employees at Chrysler's massive assembly plant, one in 10 workers in the county, lost their jobs. But Kenosha still had its Chrysler engine plant. Fox got called back.
I ended up working another 10 years, and then they shut down November 1st of 2010, and that was the day I retired.
Today, he serves on Kenosha's city council. The federal government may have saved Chrysler and a lot of endangered auto plants across the Midwest, but it didn't save Kenosha's engine plant or its remaining 800 jobs paying $28 an hour.
For a while there, it looked pretty bleak, but yet Kenosha pulled out. We turned something bad into a positive.
The decrepit assembly plant that dominated Kenosha's lakefront, in the 90s, it got torn down and cleaned up with money from Chrysler and the feds. And now, it's Harbor Park, with a vintage electric trolley clanging round.
It's condominiums, you know, kind of a lifestyle center. It's public access to the lakefront, a boardwalk, a marina.
Todd Battle is president of the Kenosha Area Business Alliance. He says the lakefront's attracted shops and restaurants and commuters.
We've seen a tremendous amount of residential development. The economy has become more diverse, stable, less cyclical, and tied to the auto industry.
Today, local unemployment's just 3.3%. Poverty and median household income are comparable to levels nationwide. Battle says Kenosha marketed its strategic location along I-94, connecting Chicago to all points north. And now it's attracted
distribution centers and logistics facilities, advanced manufacturing operations, food processing. You see companies like Amazon to Uline to SC Johnson.
And soon, Taiwanese electronics company Foxconn, which is planning a major plant nearby. John Fox says the region has attracted new jobs to replace those in the auto plants, but the standard of living they offer can fall short.
The pay is not there to what I had when, you know, I was growing up or I was a young adult.
Peggy Applegate Piplinski is president of UAW Local 72 in Kenosha, which mostly looks after retirees. She worked 30 years at Chrysler and remembers when her daughter and son-in-law were starting out looking for jobs there.
I went over to the office and I said, if this isn't going to be a job for a long term, don't hire him. It would have been nice if there was this here, but it isn't. It isn't there no more.
Harbor Park was just the first step in Kenosha's redevelopment. The old engine plant that Chrysler shuttered in 2010, it's now been torn down and the land cleared. Plans are in the works for athletic and educational facilities and a center to promote technology jobs. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Not all that long ago, downtown Los Angeles, while not exactly a place where they rolled up the sidewalks at night, wasn't exactly hopping either. Now, though, and many billions of dollars later, there are things to do here after dark, and a lot of them happen at a place called LA Live. Restaurants, bars, the Microsoft Theater, home to the Emmy Awards, hotels and Staples Center, home to the Lakers and the Clippers and the LA Kings hockey team. There is a lot going on. It's about a mile, give or take, down Figueroa Street from Marketplace World Headquarters. So the other day, we went for a walk and talk with Dan Beckerman. He is the CEO of the Anschutz Entertainment Group, AEG as it's known, which owns the place and all or part of its tenants' sports teams, too, and which has arguably single-handedly revitalized this part of downtown L.A. The company has done the same thing worldwide. It's got a couple of hundred entertainment and sports properties, including the Staples Center, which is where we started our walk-in and our talking with what the place was like before all the building started.
It was 1998. We broke ground on Staples Center. This was not the best part of the city.
Yeah.
I think back then, downtown LA was just known as the financial center.
Right.
And when you look around today and you see these buildings popping up all around us, it's become so much more than that. It's still the business center and the financial center, but it's also the sports and entertainment center. It's the culinary center. It's the cultural center in a lot of different ways.
More to the point, it's a place where people come at night.
Absolutely. I mean, and a lot of that development, I mean, it's no secret. We've poured billions of dollars into downtown Los Angeles, but we also focus on what we're good at. So we are not residential developers. We're not retail developers. So what we see in a lot of these projects, not just here in downtown LA, but other projects, is other developers coming in and putting their capital in and building these other pieces of it. And that's kind of a rewarding part of it. And we focus on our core.
In a way, you were betting on the come, right?
Well, we make bets in big cities, obviously, but it's not just about what cities you go into. It's about places in the city that need economic redevelopment, So we come into downtown Los Angeles, we go into East London, we go into East Berlin. So we believe in the big markets, but it's as much about where in the market as opposed to just the market itself.
As we walk here, can we talk timing for a second? Because
sure.
2007 and 2008 was no time at all in this economy to be opening some giant bazillion-dollar investment.
Yeah, the downturn was certainly a factor, especially, you know, with the hotel development.
Yeah.
And I don't think that any business in the world is recession-proof.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, the lesson that we learned coming out of 2007, 8, and 9 is that our business, not just here in downtown L.A., but really internationally in a lot of ways, is recession-resistant.
Huh.
And I think it's because of the markets that we're in, the nature of sports and entertainment, and that we have great assets, whether it's the O2 in London or Staples right. Center or the Kings or the Lakers or the Galaxy. There are,
ooh.
So now, all right, so,
I'm going to interrupt myself. It's another big boomy space.
We'll come back to the recession in a second.
So this is the tunnel.
So this is the underground tunnel. So this was not built when Staples Center opened.
Yeah.
And the Microsoft Theater, you know, Staples Center across the street, 20,000 seats, Microsoft Theater, 7,000 seats. So when we were building LA Live, we wanted to be able to capitalize on a lot of the infrastructure that we had at Staples Center. We have a whole bunch of staff locker rooms and a huge commissary for our concessionaire.
Right.
And we have all of these back-of-the-house services. So we thought, well, do we need to build all of that again with this new 7,000-seat venue across the street? Or is there somewhere where we can connect these and leverage the infrastructure that we had?
And here we are.
So we built this tunnel, which enables us, you come in here on any given Friday or Saturday when we have events going at both the theater and Staples Center.
And when there's a gazillion people up in the plaza up
right above us.
Yeah.
There are thousands of people there.
Yeah.
This is a buzzing corridor with people and staff and food and beverage going underneath.
Man, this is gritty down here. You weren't kidding back of the house.
Honestly, these places are where I'm most comfortable.
Huh.
This is home sweet
home.
Look a little bit gritty.
No,
but,
it's good. You got the beer kegs stacked up, and you got the food trolleys going by.
We got a game tonight.
Oh, look at this. Okay, I know where we are now.
So this is the corner of the floor. We have the Clippers tonight, so any moment now we'll have the visiting team probably doing their shoot-around.
Yeah.
So this is the time of the season where we'll do 240 events a year, and this is the season where a lot of them happen. There's a lot of compression in the schedule.
So we're standing literally on the corner of the basketball court, as you can probably hear over there. Why did LA need this campus? Why do we need it?
Well, it's funny when you think back in 1997 when I started, we were back at the Forum in Inglewood.
Not in Inglewood.
All of the venues in the market were really old. They were all built in the 60s and the 70s. So there was a real hole in the market for a state of the art venue. You look at the markets around the country. Every market had a state of the art venue, and some a lot lesser markets than Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So I think that was where the vision for AEG started, was with the acquisition of the LA Kings back in 1995. And this vision to build an arena in downtown Los Angeles.
What's your nightmare then, right? I mean, what keeps you up at night? Because here you are running a global company with global brands. What are you worried about?
Well, I think about macro things. I think about micro things. Yeah. Now we're 28,000 employees, over 200 venues all over the world. So on any given moment, right now there's an event going on somewhere within AEG.
Wow.
So with all of those events going on, I think a lot about safety and security. You know, it's an extremely high priority. On the macro side, again, I think about the economy.
What do you think about the economy? Because here we are, you know, it's the expansion is long in the tooth, and you run a company that depends a lot on discretionary income.
Mm-hmm.
What's your economic stress level?
Well, like we were talking about earlier, in 2008, I think one of the lessons learned is that in many ways we are recession-resistant, not recession-proof, but still we're investing a lot of capital. We're investing. So we have to be careful and selective with the risks that we take and the projects that we take on. We're always going to be a growing company. Our company has grown every year. We've set records in revenue and growth in the last 6 years. And with the economy, we have to be careful, but there's also opportunity that comes with some of the economic distress.
AEG owns or operates the Kings, the LA Galaxy, in Major League Soccer. Also has a slice of the Lakers. You got a favorite?
I love all my children the same. I love them all the same.
Man.
I'll tell you, there's a lot. I am passionate, and our fans know. They see me at every game. They know that I'm as passionate as they are about the teams. And I do. I love the teams. It's also, we have a vested interest in making sure that our teams are successful. So in addition to it being rewarding for us to be at the games and watch us win, it's also good for our business when we're successful. So I do love them all.
I still think he's got a favorite. I'm just saying. Dan Beckerman there, the president and CEO of AEG, standing on the floor at Staples Center. You know what really, really helps Dan's business model? More fannies in more seats is what. So we took a look at ticket sales at Staples, the cost of a seat for a Laker game and a Clippers game. Check it out, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, kind of the Amazon conundrum in reverse. Amy was telling us about how Amazon's tech worker pipeline might have an issue getting more workers to Washington and New York. We go now to Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is offering a $10,000 relocation package with a catch. You get a $500 monthly stipend, $1,500 bonus at the end of 12 months, some other stuff as well. But you can't actually work in Tulsa. You have to be a full-time telecommuter employed someplace else. Just got to live in Tulsa. As we have said many a time in other contexts, cities and countries need population growth to get economic growth. Holy cow, look at the time we got to go. Let's just call it a down day on Wall Street, shall we? Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you later, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.